MacCast, Wednesday, July 1st, 2015. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Lots of things to talk about today. Specifically, a lot of what we're going to be talking about, of course, is Apple Music. Apple released the updates for OS X and iOS 8. We'll talk about those a little bit, but the big part of that is Apple's new music service, which launched yesterday. I don't know if you've been listening to it or playing around with it. I have been a lot over the last couple days. And so we're going to get into all the nitty-gritty. I'll share some of my thoughts with you, talk about some of the things that people have discovered in terms of features and functionalities, tips and tricks and stuff like that. So should be really, really good. We're also going to talk about what's next for Apple, what's on the horizon, specifically the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus. Also some rumors of a possible new iMac out there. A bunch of software updates came along with the updates to the operating system. We'll get into those a little bit for you. And Apple Watch is coming to some more countries. We have all that and then a lot of feedback this week. I got a lot of great feedback from you from the last couple episodes, the MacCast. And so we have some additional information, additional things to get into and discuss. I have to make a little correction to something, an error I made on the Apple Music rates last episode that you called me out on, which was a good thing because I had that way off. We're going to talk a little bit more about passwords. We've covered that on the last couple shows. How to, you know, set up and pick a good password. I've had a lot of people write in with their thoughts and opinions, and we sort of need to expand that discussion a little bit. So we'll get into that in this episode. Also have an update on booting from an external SSD and then a couple new things for you. All of that and a whole lot more. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and recognize one of our sponsors, and actually a new sponsor here on the MacCast that I am very excited about. It is TunnelBear. TunnelBear is a VPN service. It offers a really simple app that helps you browse the internet privately and get around blocked websites. They have over 5 million users. It is super easy to use, and it just lets you protect yourself when you're online. You can browse privately. You can get around the censorship and blocked websites. You can surf as if you're in another country, which can be helpful in some instances. It encrypts all of your traffic that is going through the VPN, so it can't be seen by governments or your ISP or your corporations, so you can keep your internet surfing private. And this is, I think, really important. It secures your internet when you're on public Wi-Fi. That can be really important when you're traveling, you're working on that hotel Wi-Fi, maybe you're at a cafe. You need to keep that stuff protected. You know that guy with the laptop in the corner? It's kind of dark over there. He looks a little shady, and he's got hacker stickers all over his laptop. Do you really trust him? What's he doing over there? Do you ever wonder that? I wonder that when I go into the coffee shop. And I'm joking a little bit, but you know what I'm talking about. This is serious stuff. When you're on that public Wi-Fi, I think it really is better to be safe than sorry. And they have mobile and desktop and browser apps. They're on iOS, Mac, Chrome. And what I really liked about it is the installation and setup is super easy. You can turn your VPN on and off with a simple click. The setup and installation is a snap. You can be online and protected with VPN in literally seconds. And like I said, you can tunnel to 14 different countries, which allows you to browse the internet as if you're in one of those countries. And sometimes you need that to get around restrictions and things like that you might encounter online. And I think one of the big important things with VPN in my mind, one of my biggest concerns is that when you're picking a VPN, you have to trust your VPN provider. You have to know what they're doing because all of your information is going through them. So they have to be a trusted source. And what I loved about TunnelBear is I think they have one of the most transparent privacy policies I've seen for any service. Forget VPN. It is very clear what they're doing with your information, what they're collecting. They only collect the absolute minimum amount of information they need to provide you the service, and they make that very, very clear. So I would encourage you, when you go check out the service at tunnelbear.com/MacCast, go to the privacy and Terms of Service section and just check out how they have it laid out. It's in plain English. It's easy to understand. And to me, that helps build up the trust. And their pricing is amazing. You can actually try it out completely free or use it free for up to 500 megabytes per month. If you need more than that, they have unlimited plans starting at $4.99 a month or just $49.99 for a year. And that allows you to use the service with up to 3 computers or devices. So check it out now, tunnelbear.com/Maccast if you want to give it a try. And a big thank you to Tunnel Bear for their support of the Maccast. I know you probably are excited to get into the Apple Music stuff, but I am going to do the thing that we do sometimes in podcasts and radio and television. I'm going to bury the lead because I think we have a few things that we need to get into before we get into that. That's going to be a big section, and I want to have the time to just really dive into that. So starting off the episode this week, I want to talk about what we think we know about what's next from Apple. And specifically, that means the next iPhones, the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus. That's what everybody is assuming. They think they know what the models are going to be. Ming-Chi Kuo is saying that Apple has been upping its orders for flexible printed circuit boards, and these would be things that would be necessary for incorporating Force Touch into the next generation iPhone. So Apple has introduced Force Touch in the Apple Watch, and now we're getting it on our trackpads. Most folks are thinking that the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus are going to come with Force Touch sensors. And specifically, these sensors are being said to not just be able to detect force touches, but can also monitor where on the screen it's being pressed and how much pressure is being used. They're said to be more advanced sensors, up to 2.5 times more expensive than the sensor that's in the Apple Watch, and able to do a bit more. So I would assume within the software, there might be some more functionality and tricks and things like that that we'll be able to see with Force Touch on the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus. As far as the form factor, we're hearing that they're going to be roughly the same size. Some reports have been saying they might be a little bit thicker, and there's two reasons being cited for that. One might be the Force Touch technology, excuse me. The other one is that they may build the case out of the same aluminum that they've been using in the Apple Watch. That's the 7000 series aluminum, and I guess that would be a little bit thicker. Now, that being said, we also had some supposed leaked images recently, and those contradicted the idea that it would be a little bit thicker. The measurements on those were exactly the same as the current models, both the 6S and the 6S Plus. And what was cited in those images was that only the internal mounting locations appeared to be different. So usually in the off years, in the S series years, you don't get a lot of external or large design changes in the iPhone. It's seeming like that's going to be the case this time around. A few other things that we're hearing about. There's this rumor out there that there might be a dual camera system for the EyeSight camera. Now, I've been poking around and I can't really figure out why we would need a dual lens system, but imagine you have two camera lenses on the back of the iPhone. And reportedly, this has been something that Apple's been playing around with and investigating for a few years, but they were having problems with blurred images and not being able to find suppliers to supply enough camera lenses to actually have two lenses or two cameras in the iPhone. But apparently Apple acquired an Israeli company called Linx Imaging, and that company developed a multi-aperture camera system designed for mobile devices. So that's sort of what's leading this rumor here. And they also say that Apple has found a supplier for the camera sensors, a company named Largan, and they're supposedly going to get 80% of all iPhone 6S and 6S Plus camera orders or camera lens orders. So we'll have to wait and see. If you happen to know why we would want two lenses in there, I'm assuming it has to do with just getting a better shot, maybe being able to take both exposures and then combine them into one image in the software to do up sharpening and stuff like that. Maybe it's with multi-focus. I would assume there's some pretty neat things that you could do if you had two lenses in there within the software, but again, I didn't see in the reports specifically why we would want two lenses. So I'm a little bit curious. If you're in imaging and you happen to know, shoot me an email, mattcast@gmail.com. The other rumor we've been hearing a lot about, and we've actually heard this for years, is that Apple eventually wants to do away with the home button on the iPhone. Now, this is unlikely to happen in this release, but maybe sometime in the future. What is going on is Apple reportedly acquired more than 24 biometric authentication patents from a company in Virginia called Prevaris, and this was via a report over on CNN. Now, what's interesting about Prevaris is, as near as anyone can tell, the company really hasn't been active since 2009. So it looks like possibly they've just simply been kind of sitting on this patent, on these patents, almost becoming like a patent holding company. And there hasn't been any sort of report that Apple is looking to acquire the company, just simply that they acquired these patents. And these patents specifically deal with integrated fingerprint sensing technology that would be put into touchscreens. So that sort of led to this thought, well, you know, Apple is looking to get rid of the home button, make more room on the screen for just, you know, having a giant screen there, more images. And then you could potentially do more things in software if you just sort of had a virtual button that was on the screen. I don't know how you feel about this, but I actually like the home button. I like having a physical thing that I can click on. It's sort of comforting to know that if things are going wrong, if I need to reboot the phone, right, I can do the whole sleep-wake button, home button trick, reboot it. I don't know how that would work in a virtual system. I've played around with the Android phones that have the sort of quasi buttons. You know, they're not really buttons. They're just little spaces you touch on the screen and you can go back or go home. And I've never really liked that. I also think just for accessibility, having the home button there really can help you with orientation. Even just for me, like how many of us have reached over? You've probably done this. I do this all the time. It's at night. You've got your iPhone there. You reach over and you just feel to figure out where the home button is so that you know you have it in the right orientation when you turn it on. I do that all the time. So I'd hate to see that go away, but it might be happening eventually. So we just have one sort of slab of glass with the, without the home button in there. Another thing that we've been hearing about in the new iPhone designs is there may be an improved LTE chip from Qualcomm, a chip called the MDM9635M, or more easily being referred to as the 9X35 chip. The big deal on here is it runs at about twice the speed, twice the download speed of the current iPhone LTE chips, about 300 megabits per second on the download speed. It's also said to be more power efficient and more compact, which are two good things for Apple in terms of squeezing it into the super slim design of the iPhone. It gives them a little bit more room for maybe other things like, I don't know, maybe an extra camera sensor. I would hope maybe even a little bit more battery. But again, remember that the iPhone case design is going to be the same size. So if you're able to free up some more space in there, you're going to have more space to do a few more things. And so some of the other things that we're hearing about in the next generation iPhone, improved camera. So if we don't get a dual sensor or two camera sensors, at least we've been hearing there might be a bump to a 12 megapixel camera. We already talked about the 7000 series aluminum. And there's also been that rumor that there may be a new color, the rose gold, not actual gold, but just the color rose gold to kind of match the rose gold Apple Edition watch. So that's about, you know, all the latest on the iPhone 6 and, or excuse me, 6S and 6S Plus. There's also been a rumor surfacing this week that we may get an iPhone 6C, so an update to the iPhone 5C model. This time around, it would be a slightly tweaked version, according to reports, of the iPhone 5S, but inside a metal case. So Apple ditching the plastic case and moving back to a metal case on the iPhone 6C. Now, there haven't been reports on whether or not those would be in colors or what colors they might be. I would hope they would continue the colors because that's kind of the distinctive feature, I think, of the C line, right, is that you get those things in the various colors. So they could do different colors anodized in metal, and I think they could potentially look really nice, just like the iPods do now. So if you imagine those kind of colors translated over to an iPhone 6C, That's what I think it would probably look like. Another thing that happened, speaking of iPods, is that when iTunes 12.2 came out, and we're going to talk about that as it relates to Apple Music here in a bit, but when it came out, developers poked around, as they often do, and they noticed that there were some assets and some images and some hints of potential updated iPods in the form of new colors. It looks like there would be an update to the iPod Touch, Nano, and Shuffle lines, so updates across the board. And what they saw was there were some new colors, a bright pink, a deep blue, and kind of a light gold. Now, they're saying light gold. To me, the gold looked like it was sort of a gold that would almost match the gold that we have in the MacBook line that we have in the iPhone. So kind of a goldish color. And that is along with the silver, space gray, and red colors, which are already in the current lineup. The deep blue, I think, looks really, really nice from the images that I've seen online. The pink is pretty bright, if you prefer that sort of thing. There's no indication of any internal changes, so we don't have any details on, you know, if they're going to change anything with respect to the lineup inside. But I'm really hoping that at least on the iPod Touch line that they bump it up to 128 gigabytes of storage, especially considering the fact that they discontinued the iPod Classic. I think that's, you know, we need to get up to that larger storage size for folks who have larger music libraries. Now, you could argue in the other direction, now that we have Apple Music and streaming music services, that you don't need as much internal storage. But I think there's people out there that really like to have large libraries and take those libraries with them. And I've actually received emails from some of you saying exactly that. So I think it'd be nice if Apple would just have the option of a little bit more storage in the iPod Touch lineup. Another thing that was discovered with the latest El Capitan beta by developers were some references to a design that would potentially indicate a new iMac. A lot of people are speculating that there may be a 21.5-inch 4K iMac on the horizon. What they found were references for a Retina display with a resolution of 4096 by 2304. And there were also references to an Intel Iris Pro graphics card, a 6200 graphics chipset. So this could be something that could come along with either a Broadwell quad-core or, I think more likely, a Skylake processor. Intel just put out a couple of Broadwell processors that might work in the iMac, but rumor is that Skylakes are right on the horizon, and those seem to be on track. So I think Apple may opt to wait a little bit longer to get a Skylake processor in an updated 21.5-inch iMac. And 9to5 Mac really thinks that this combo of the Intel Iris Pro Graphics 6200 and the increased screen size would be a perfect fit for a Retina 21.5-inch iMac update. Considering right now we only have Retina on the iMac in the form of the 27-inch 5K model. There also apparently was a mention of AMD Radeon M380 and M395X graphics in the update, so that could indicate that there could be some higher level models as well. So you could get, you know, on the lower end, the integrated Iris Pro graphics, and then bump up to AMD Radeon, which would make a nice little bump and update to the lower end of the iMac lineup. And then lastly, some speculation about the Apple TV. El Capitan apparently also had references to what looks like a Bluetooth remote control that many are speculating would be destined for a next-generation Apple TV. The reference seems to indicate hardware with a dedicated Bluetooth wireless chipset with the ability to also connect devices via an infrared sensor and something that would have a multi-touch trackpad. So it's been rumored for a while that Apple might update the remote on the next-generation Apple TV with something that would have either a touchscreen or a touchpad built into it. And these references seem to indicate that at least support for that is in the operating system. Now, why it's inside El Capitan is a little bit interesting, although we do know that at its core, you know, Apple uses the core of the OS across the board on a lot of things, including the Apple TV. It's being said that in the hardware, it would make the remote for the Apple TV slightly thicker than the current model, and that would be to accommodate the touchpad. Something I was glad to hear, though, is the reports are saying that Apple would retain the menu and the play button. So you'd still have those two physical buttons, I would assume, up above the trackpad. I wouldn't mind also if Apple made that remote a little bit bigger in general. I don't know about you, but I'm constantly losing that thing. It's probably the most hated remote in my household because you can never find the darn thing. So I would love it if they maybe squared it out, made a bigger trackpad area, and added a couple buttons. That would not bother me in the slightest. Now, can Johnny Ive live with that? I don't really know, but we'll find out. Ultimately, I'd really like to see them do something like the iPod Nano form factor, you know, tall and thin with a touch screen on it. That would be really, really cool, and I think there's some good things you could do with that design. As a matter of fact, Apple designer Martin Hajek did some mock-ups of a next-generation Apple TV that were based on the designs of, I think, the iPhone 5 or 5S. So you had an Apple TV in different metal enclosures, space gray, silver, and gold, along with the chamfered edges. And then he did a really beautiful mock-up of this touchscreen Apple TV remote. So in my dream world, that's what Apple would produce. But I don't think it's going to be quite as slick as that. I think we're just looking at a plain old sort of metal casing remote with a touchpad on it. Now, some people are thinking maybe it'll have force touch technology in there as well. That does seem to be the direction Apple is going, so it wouldn't surprise me if that turned out to be the case. But that's kind of the latest on speculation of what new hardware and things we think are coming on the horizon. This week, also, before we get into the Apple Music stuff, we saw a number of software updates from Apple in addition to the ones that were supporting the Apple Music launch. iTunes U got a really nice update with support for homework hand-in, integrated PDF annotations, gradebooks, and one-to-one discussions. Apparently, the updates to iTunes U were the result of feedback from real teachers and students who had been using iPads and iTunes U in the classroom. Apple took those to heart and threw in new features. Discussions are going to enable teachers and students to connect so that everyone can sort of have more of a in-classroom type learning. You can contribute towards, you know, having that back and forth discussion as you're working through iTunes U courses. The homework hand-in includes the ability to timestamp when the homework comes in, so you're not going to get away with cheating or turning in stuff late. It also gives the ability to annotate PDFs with marks, so I would assume that teachers can sort of grade and give feedback. Makes it easy to exchange term papers, book reports, essays, problem sets, all of that sort of stuff. There's also direct import for the teaching materials and student work into iTunes U from all of Apple's iWork applications, Keynote, Pages, also from iMovie, Explain Everything, Stop Motion Studio, Book Creator, a whole bunch more stuff there, and the gradebook integration, so teachers can track the students' work and even send push notifications as reminders. So you might want to, if you haven't updated iTunes U to version 3.0, you might want to check that out. And while you're there, check out Apple has a new teaching app development with Swift course for high school instructors. This is to help high school teachers be able to use Swift in the classroom, teach app development at the high school level. And I guess this was a course from WWDC. It's really cool because you can get lesson plans, project files, even GitHub sample code all directly through the iTunes U app. So if you've been looking for something to check, a reason to check out iTunes U, that might be something you want to take a look at. iOS 8.4 was released. Again, this was mostly to support Apple Music. More on that later. There were also updates to the Mini Player. The Now Playing screen looks a little bit different. There's a new global search, and of course, you've got the new radio feature in there with Beats Radio 1. Something that was taken out of the music app in iOS 8.4 is audiobooks. Audiobooks have been moved from music into iBooks. There are also now the ability to use books made for iBooks on iPhone as well as iPad. And there's a new setting that lets you turn off the auto night theme. And Apple also pushed out an update for audiobooks in CarPlay. I guess audiobooks now has a standalone app in CarPlay. So if you have a CarPlay receiver and like listening to audiobooks in the car, that's going to be a little bit easier on that side of things. OS X Yosemite 10.10.4 was released. I was very excited to get this update because it replaces the broken Discovery D that we've been talking about here on the MacCast, the thing that screws up all of your networking. That has been replaced with good old MDNS Responder. So that should take care of a lot of networking issues. If you've been having trouble surfing the internet, if you've had that weird thing with suddenly where suddenly your Mac starts renaming itself and putting a number on the end when you see it on your home network. So, you know, like mine started saying MacBook Pro 2, MacBook Pro 3. Really, really annoying. Hopefully all of that stuff will be cleaned up. Also in the 10.10.4 update, it addresses an issue that prevented some external displays from functioning properly, improves the reliability of upgrading iPhoto and Aperture libraries to Photos, improves reliability when syncing photos and videos to iCloud Photo Library. I have to say, I did that. I did an update after I had updated to 10.10.4, and I still noticed that I was having trouble with a little progress bar in iCloud Photo Library. So I'm not really sure if that one is a full fix yet or not. 10.10.4 also addresses an issue that could cause photos to unexpectedly quit after importing some Leica DNG files, digital negative files, resolves an issue that could delay outgoing messages and email. I think I was suffering from that as well. I didn't even know that was a 10.10.3 problem, but I guess it should be fixed now in 10.10.4. And then finally, fixes an issue where a website could prevent a user from navigating away by presenting a repeated JavaScript alert in Safari. And I know I've been hit by that one. You type the wrong website into a Google search, right? And suddenly you're getting all these pop-ups and you can't get out of it. Really annoying. So nice to know that that's fixed. So grab those two updates if you haven't already. And then iTunes 12.2 was also released. That has the updates for Apple Music. A few other things to be aware of. GarageBand received an update, 10.1. It has bug fixes, also updates for the new Force Touch gestures, and the ability to publish directly to Apple Music Connect. So if you're an indie music artist and you want to get your stuff into iTunes, GarageBand is this update's going to make it a lot easier for you to do that. And then there was a ton of new content in the forms of loops and patches, new drums or drum kits. So it looks like a really nice update, but the thing is I can't update because I need them to bring back podcast support before I can upgrade. So I'm going to stick with iTunes 6 or GarageBand rather 6.0.5 for as long as I possibly can, to be honest, because I don't think they're ever bringing the podcast features back into GarageBand as much as I hope that they absolutely do. And then there was also a GarageBand update for GarageBand on iOS. It was just really the bug fixes and the Apple Music Connect publishing stuff. It doesn't have any of the other updates in the update to GarageBand on iOS. There were also some minor updates to iBooks Author and iMovie in case you missed those. And then the last thing to let you know about, there was, if you're running OS X Mavericks or Mountain Lion, there was an EFI security update 2015-001. It fixes some issues and prevents a malicious application from potentially gaining root privileges by modifying the EFI's flash memory. It also shut down a memory corruption bug, something known as Rowhammer. And if you're running OS X Yosemite, the same security updates, EFI security updates, were part of the 10.10.4 update. So you only need to grab that separately if you're running an older version of the operating system, Mavericks or Mountain Lion. But with that, that is all of the latest software and app updates that came out from Apple this week. The Apple Watch is going to be coming to more countries. As a matter of fact, last week, the Apple Watch went on sale in 7 more countries: Italy, Mexico, Singapore, South Korea, Spain, Switzerland, and Taiwan. But now it looks like Apple's website for the Netherlands, Sweden, and Thailand have all been updated to show a July 17th availability date for the Apple Watch. And when Cult of Mac saw this, they did some more checking. They dug in and looked at all of Apple's international websites and found that 13 that had previously announced The Apple Watch is coming soon, are now saying available in 2015. And those countries are India, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Malaysia, New Zealand, Belgium, Denmark, Norway, Austria, Russia, Finland, Turkey, and Brazil. Now, there's not firm dates for those locations. It's only saying available in 2015, but that is a change from prior. And the speculation is that, you know, Apple is working on getting distribution agreements finalized in the various countries. So the hope is that maybe a few more of these will be added to the list for the July 17th launch. If you happen to be in one of those countries, I would say stay tuned to the Apple Watch website for your local region to see when and if those dates get updated. All right, let's get to that lead story I've been teasing you with. Apple Music has dropped. We've got a few more details about the service. It launched with over 30 million songs available to stream and download. That is a pretty impressive collection, although I'm reading it's pretty much on par with what Spotify and some of the other streaming services have. As we knew, you can sign up to get a free 3-month trial. You get 90 days for free, and then after that, in the U.S., it's going to be $9.99 a month for a single user, $14.99 for a family plan, and that's going to cover up to 6 people. But what we didn't know is that pricing could be a lot cheaper or maybe a little bit more expensive depending upon the country that you're in. The absolute best deal on Apple Music is in India. It's 120 rupees for the single user plan and 190 rupees for the family plan. That translates to, in US dollars, about $1.89 for the individual plan per month and $2.99 for the family plan. A little bit more expensive in Brazil, but still a good deal. Roughly $4.99 US and $7.99 US for the individual and family plans, respectively. In Hong Kong, $6.19 US, and obviously doing the conversions here, $10.06 for the family plan. So those are some of the best deals internationally on Apple Music. Now, if you happen to be in Italy, you're going to pay a little bit more, it looks like. It's €9.99 and €14.99, which translates into $11.05 US for the individual plan and $16.57 for the family plan. And right now, it's looking like the most expensive place to get into an Apple Music plan is in the UK, £9.99 or £14.99 sterling, I guess is how you would say it. And that equates to about $15.60 US for the individual single user plan and $23.41 for the family plan. Of course, that is monthly. So Apple seems to be adjusting the pricing depending upon the region. Nobody's really certain why. I would imagine there's a few factors that go into it, including sort of regional licensing deals, also probably exchange rates. But then also I think there's probably, you know, what Apple thinks they can get for the service in the various regions. And I'm also wondering if maybe the music collections vary or the amount of music that's available varies from country to country. But I think right now I'm pretty jealous of the folks in India who are able to get into Apple Music for about $2 a month. I think that's a killer deal. I think if they did that everywhere, Apple would not be able to. I think their entire service system would melt down, because I think probably about 90% of the world would get on Apple Music. But as far as how the process goes, let's talk a little bit about using Apple Music. Of course, you have to get iOS 8.4, or you have to download OS 10.10.4 along with the iTunes 12.2 update. But once you fire it up and you say you want to start using Apple Music, what they'll do is they'll ask you to select your favorite artists and genres by using these little bubbles that pop up on the screen. And what you do is you tap once for... It'll present you with a number of artists. And you tap once if you like that artist, and the bubble gets a little bit bigger. Tap again, and it gets even bigger. So you tap once for the artists that you like, twice for the artists or genres that you really, really like. And then you can tap, I think, and hold a button to sort of pop that bubble or get rid of it to say, hey, I really don't like that artist. And I think there's also a link down at the bottom so you can bring up more bubbles to pick from. So if you don't like the ones that are up there, you can say, hey, give me another set of them. And you go through and you basically tell it what you like to listen to. You know, what are your musical tastes? And then from that point forward, it's going to use that information and data along with the additional things that you add to your music library, the things that you like, or I think they call it love, because they use a little heart symbol, the thing, the, you know, the music that you love on the Apple Music service. And as you fill that out, it will make better and better recommendations for other kinds of music that's available within the service that you might like. So it'll present you playlists, and those things are done with algorithms and also human curated. And so far, that's been pretty good for me. But then once you get into the Apple Music service, everything's organized into these five tabs. They have a For You section down at the bottom. And so you'll see that the tabs that are down at the bottom are different than what were in Music before. You now have this new For You tab. That's going to be the recommendations. Next to that, you have New. That's all the latest stuff that's showing up in the Apple Music library. So new albums, new artists, charts, things like that. Then you have the new radio tab, which includes the new Beats One radio service along with your radio stations, although they're a little bit different. Let's start out. A couple things I want to mention on Beats One. So Beats One is Apple's live 24/7 global radio service. It's been launched and made available in 100 countries simultaneously. It sounds and behaves and acts just like you would think a traditional radio station does. So they've got DJs talking and leading in music. And there's all kinds of different programs. Apple actually posted a website over on Tumblr, applemusic.tumblr.com, that has the Beats One schedule. So if you want to see what's coming up, or on your iOS device, when you go into the radio tab, you can tap on the Beats One artwork in the radio section, and it will show you the upcoming schedule for that day, so you can see the programs that are coming up. In addition to the Beats One radio in the radio section, you have additional featured stations. Those are ones that are picked by Apple. And then you can also start your own stations as you're browsing through music. So from a song or an artist, when you get into the menus, there is a, you know, start a station button, and you can tap on that, and that will get added into the radio section within the music app. And if you had previously created stations under iTunes Radio, those are also in here. It's a little bit weird how it works, though, because in the interface, it kind of shows the stations that you've listened to most recently under a section called Recently Added. And then you actually have to tap on that and drill in to actually see all of the stations that you've created. The Recently Added label, I think, to me, is a little bit confusing. But that's how you get into those in case you missed it. All of your old iTunes radio stations are converted into new Apple Music radio stations. And my only complaint there is it doesn't seem like you can manage anymore your lists of where you said play more of this kind of artist or song or genre, or never play these options. If you ever used iTunes Radio, you know you could go into the edit section and you could tweak those lists. It appears in Apple Music you can still add to those lists or detract from those lists. So you still have the options to say play more music like this or never play this song. But once it's gone into that radio station, it's all behind the scenes, and I cannot personally find any way to get back in there and manage it. If you happen to discover a way to do that, let me know. Shoot me an email, mattcast@gmail.com. So far I haven't been able to do that. And then there are also, underneath all those stations, sort of what I'm calling the genre stations. So they have preset stations organized by genre. So if you like pop music, or you like rock or hard rock or all those sorts of things, they have stations preset up for that, that you can tap on and listen to. A little bit more on Beats One. Beats One actually does some request shows, and there are a couple different ways that you can request to hear songs on Beats One Radio. If you go to beatsoneradio.com/requests, They have different international phone numbers that you can call in on. You can also apparently send an iMessage, including audio messages. And I actually was listening to Beats One Radio today and heard some audio requests. People had recorded audio messages and then sent them to BeatsOneRadio@iCloud.com. And Beats One, the one is actually the number one. So it's BEATS, the number one, radio@iCloud.com. Send an iMessage there with your request. And if you do an audio message, you might actually hear your voice on Beats One Radio, which is kind of pretty cool. And then you can also tweet your requests. You can tweet requests to hashtag Beats One Radio, Beats the number one requests. So put that hashtag on there and they'll put those in there. I think the requests are really only valid when the request shows are going on. So you might want to check the schedule. And there actually is a show called Requests that it aired this week on Tuesday from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. I don't know if that's going to be a regularly scheduled thing every week or every day. It's not clear at this point, but check your schedule and you should be able to figure that out. So that's kind of all the radio stuff. And then the next tab that's in there is the Connect tab. This is Apple's social effort for artists. So an artist can get in there and they can post all kinds of things, videos, lyrics, audio, just text messages, photos. They can do that stuff out to their fans, anybody who follows them. So you'll notice as you're browsing around in the music app, there's a little follow button on the artist pages so you can add to follow artists. And this is the section that you would go into to get those updates. You also, when an artist posts something, you have the ability to comment on it. Individual users, you know, you can't go in there and create your own posts, but you can comment on posts that the artists have already put up there. And related to this, when you're in the Connect section, if you look in the upper left-hand corner, there's a little profile icon on iOS, or if you click on your profile icon in iTunes on the Mac, you can go into your account, and that's where you can manage who you want to follow or who you're following. Something that's a little bit annoying, in my opinion, is by default, it is set to automatically follow any artists who you have music for already. So you'll notice when you go into Connect, you're suddenly following all kinds of artists, whether you wanted to or not. So you can go into that section under the profile and change the follow settings, at least on iOS, and you can go in and unfollow artists. It seemed like in iTunes on the Mac, to actually unfollow an artist, you have to go to that artist's page and then click the unfollow button, or don't follow. I can't remember what it said. But another important thing is from that profile section within Connect, you can also tap on your name and claim your Apple Music nickname. So if you want to claim an Apple Music nickname, that name is what's going to be used when you actually post a comment to a Connect post. So you may want to jump in there and claim your name. I have already claimed MacCast, so you can't have that one, but any other one that is available, you'll probably want to grab pretty quickly because I have a feeling those are going to get eaten up. And then the last tab that is in the new music app is called My Music. And this is where you're going to find all of your music, including the stuff that was in there before you added Apple Music. And it is a little bit different. We're going to talk a little bit more about sort of navigating the interface and stuff like that a little bit later. But one of the cool things, if you are on your Apple Music subscription, is you can add various albums and tracks and they go right into the My Music section. They really don't appear any differently. It looks just like music that you own. The only thing that I noticed was that in iTunes, you can actually turn on the iCloud status column if you're in the list view. And under that, if it is an Apple Music track, it will say Apple Music instead of, you know, with the iCloud status, you could see something like matched or uploaded or purchased. There's now a new thing that says Apple Music, and that's how you know it came from your Apple Music subscription. So there's been a lot of talk, and I think we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast, of a lot of the features or some of the features that are in Apple Music working sort of like iTunes Match. So just like iTunes Match, if you're on Apple Music, anything that you have in your library that you've ripped yourself or anything that you've purchased or even stuff that you've ripped that isn't in the Apple Music library, all of those things will get uploaded into your Apple Music iCloud or your iCloud library, iCloud Music Library, I think is what they're calling it now. So that'll go up into your iCloud Music Library, just like with iTunes Match. And the speculation before the service came out was that, well, you probably don't need iTunes Match, but it came out today that there is one key difference with how it works with Apple Music versus how it works with iTunes Match. And I think we now understand why Apple is calling iTunes Match a complimentary service. Because what happens is if you get an Apple Music account and you don't have iTunes Match, yes, your tracks will be uploaded into iCloud, and yes, you'll be able to stream them and download them and do all those things as long as you have an Apple Music subscription. But the minute that you cancel that, you lose access to all of that music, because what was discovered is that even though it might upload stuff from your own library that's not in the Apple Music library, when it comes back down, it is DRM'd. And this is specifically for Match stuff. I take it back because I don't know with 100% certainty it is for just uploaded stuff. But the point is that if you're going to use Apple Music and not have an iTunes Match subscription, you're going to want to make sure that you keep a copy of everything that you rip. So don't do the thing where it's matched, it goes up into your iCloud library, and then you delete it locally to save space, knowing that you can download it again. Because while you can download it again, it comes down in that Apple Music format, and the Apple Music AAC format does have DRM on it. So you're not going to be able to keep that after you cancel your Apple Music service. So if you do want to keep your matched tracks, you're probably going to want to keep iTunes Music Match, because if you have iTunes Music Match, and I confirmed that this with my own subscription, when you rip stuff, put it up into iCloud, it goes up under your iTunes Match subscription, and it will show all the same things that it has with iTunes Match. So it's still music that you own and you license, and even the Match stuff you can download again, and you'll be able to keep that because it comes back down in the un-DRM'd format. So I wanted to be really clear about that because I think that's a really big distinction and, you know, really kind of changes things. So while I'm probably going to sign up for Apple Music, I'm also not planning on canceling my Match subscription because I do like to be able to have all that music stored up in iTunes or iCloud and be able to pull that stuff down to different Macs, to my devices, and not have to worry about losing that should I stop my Apple Music subscription. So I hope that clears up that for a number of you. Another thing to talk about is, well, what if I don't want to use Apple Music? What if I want to just have my app and my library sort of work and act the same as it did before this new Apple Music service came out? So in this case, you would maybe not want the new and for you music tabs. Well, you can actually get rid of those. So if you don't plan on using Apple Music, what you can do is on the Mac in iTunes, go into Preferences, General, and uncheck the Show Apple Music option, and all of that stuff will go away. Similarly, on iOS, you go into Settings under Music, and there's a toggle for Show Apple Music. And when you turn that off, the For You and New Music sections go away, and what you're left with is just simply the Playlist tab. So you get the Playlist tab back on iOS. And if you do have Apple Music on, where the playlists live now, because where they were before at the bottom in the little tab section is taken up by the Connect tab, the playlist has been moved up and sits next to a tab, a little toggle, where you can toggle between the library and your playlist. So if you're using Apple Music, they'll be up there when you're in the My Music section. And another thing that might be immediately confusing is when you go into the My Music section, if you remember how the music app worked before, you had all the tabs down there at the bottom where you could switch between artists and playlists and genres, and you can kind of customize that thing. You had all your different sections that you could go into. Well, now because with Apple Music, you have the new and My Music and Connect and all those other new tabs, you might be wondering, well, where did all those tabs go? How do I gonna go and just view artists or albums or things like that? Well, in the main interface of My Music, at the top, there's a little category drop down, and it's set to artists by default. But if you tap on that, it will allow you to toggle and go between those different views. So if you want to look at genres or compilations, or if you want to look at artists or album, that's how you actually do it. And one nice thing about this little dropdown is it does now have a toggle for showing offline music only. So no more do you have to get out of the music app completely, go into settings, go into music, and do that toggle. You can actually do it right from within the application. And that's really handy if, you know, you're going to be in a situation where you know you're going to go to an area where you're not going to have Wi-Fi, you're not going to be able to stream. So you can quickly toggle that, check and see what music is downloaded onto your device, and then maybe flip it back on, grab a couple albums before you have to maybe hop on a plane, say, or something like that. One of the cool updates, I think, in the music app is the new mini player. So you kind of now, when you're playing music, you have this little mini player that sits along the bottom of the screen. And if you tap on the mini player, it pulls up the now playing screen. So you no longer have that little now playing button in the upper right-hand corner. All you have to do is tap on the mini player, and then everything sort of slides up. And then when you're in the when you're in the now playing screen, there's a little arrow up in the upper left-hand side that you can collapse to minimize the mini player back down. And then within the mini player, there's a little ellipses. I never remember how to say that right. The little dot, dot, dot. You tap on the little dot, dot, dot in the mini player, and that's when you will get an additional menu with share items, with the options to add the music to your music library, a bunch of other options in there. And while that is up there, while those music options are up there, you'll notice you'll have the album title at the top. And this took me a little while to discover, so I'm going to point it out to you. When you tap on the album title in the mini player, that's when it will jump and give you the full track list for the album that song is currently playing from. And also within there, you have the little add button. So if you want to add the album to your music collection, or you have the love button, if you want to say, I really like this track, you can tap on the little heart and add that to your list of. And again, when you favorite stuff like that, then it's going to help tailor your music recommendations within the music application. Another really nice thing is in the now playing window, you now have an AirPlay icon right from there. So no more fumbling and bumping around when you're trying to AirPlay your music. You can do that right from the now playing window. There's also, as I think we mentioned before, a global search. So now when you search, it's actually divided between doing searches of your music, the My Music section, or the entire Apple Music catalog, and you can kind of toggle back and forth between those to find the tracks that you're looking for. And something that is going to upset people a little bit is home sharing apparently has been removed from the music application in iOS, under iOS 8.4. Now, it is still there in iTunes 12 on the Mac, 12.2. So if you go in the file menu under iTunes, you'll still see home sharing in there. And home sharing still is on the Apple TV, but it has been removed from iOS, at least for audio. Video home sharing is still in there. So if you go into the video application, you'll still be able to actually stream movies or content that you're home sharing on your network from your Macs and things like that. What you're not going to find, though, is the audio. On the Mac side, when there is a slight, I think, UI change for home sharing, when you're in iTunes, your home shares, if they are available, if you have home shares available, it will show a little home icon that appears next to the music tab. And you can tap on that little home icon with the musical notes in it to switch between your Mac and any home shares that might be available. But again, on iOS, it has been removed. And I suspect that it was a last-minute pull, because I guess it went away in the last beta, the iOS 8.4 beta 4. And there was a note, you know, saying that that sort of made it sound like it may or may not be coming back. And my guess is it was because of licensing deals with Apple Music. And my suspicion is that the record labels are really worried that if you have the ability to do home share, you can not only share your music, you know, that you've pulled from your app, from the Apple Music library. So you have access to everything in the Apple Music library. You put that into your own music library, and now you home share it. Well, you could share that to anybody, but I think even more importantly for the labels, you can stream that music. So, you know, you're going to stream it from Apple Music, and that's going to be one credit, one streaming credit to the music rights holders. But if now I have it in my library and I'm just streaming it directly to my other Macs and not streaming it directly from the Apple Music service, so if I'm going from Mac to iOS device rather than from Apple Music direct to my iOS device, then the music rights holder is not going to get that stream credit. So that's money directly. So I don't expect that home sharing is going to be coming back, and I know that's going to upset some of you. I'd love to hear your feedback on that, what you think. You know, again, it seems more, you know, like more of this, the record labels being greedy, of course, knowing that I'm purely speculating here, but that seems to make sense, right? That's what's going on. It's at least what I think. Another thing to note is Genius Mixes are also gone in iOS 8.4. But I don't think many people are going to miss those. Did anybody use Genius Mixes? I'm sure there's some people out there that will be upset by this, but a much smaller number than the number of people that I think are going to be upset by home sharing being taken out. Good news, though, on the iTunes Music Match side of things, along with the Apple Music matching thing, it's sounding like the song limit, the 25,000 uploaded song limit, is going to be increased. It wasn't increased with iOS 8.4, but according to Eddie Q, he sent out a tweet and he said Apple is working on trying to get that limit increased to 100,000 uploaded tracks in iOS 9. So they're going to quadruple the number of tracks that you can actually upload and store in your iCloud music library, hopefully beginning with iOS 9. And speaking of iOS 9, it currently does not, the current beta of that, if you're running that, currently does not have Apple Music, did not get the Apple Music update yet, but Eddie Q also said that Apple should push out the update for iOS Beta 9 that will include Apple Music sometime next week. So you won't have that much longer to wait to get in on Apple Music if you're running the iOS 9 beta. Another bit of good news, if you're the owner of a Sonos player, I actually have a Sonos, and I played around with Beats on the Sonos for a little bit. It works great. A lot of people really, really like it. But, you know, the news came out last week that when you go with Apple Music, that's not going to be available on Sonos. And that was an official word from Sonos. Well, Apple and Sonos announced this week that they will get Apple Music support in there by the end of the year. They did not give any firm dates. And so something to be aware of, if you are a Beats subscriber and you want to continue to use Beats on your Sonos, you're going to want to make sure that you don't migrate over to Apple Music. Because the minute that you move over to Apple Music, you're going to lose the ability to have that Sonos integration, at least for Beats. And you're going to have to wait for Apple Music to show up there. And like I said, we don't know when that's going to happen. So I just wanted to point that out. I actually own a Sonos, so I'm actually looking forward to Apple Music making its way onto the service. And then finally, though, I just want to talk about my experiences with Apple Music so far and kind of what I think about it. You know, I have to say, so far, everything's been pretty smooth. I think the launch went pretty smoothly for me. I was able to, first thing in the morning, update my iOS devices to 8.4. I did have some trouble upgrading to 10.10.4, but I think it was mostly because Apple's servers were completely overloaded. When I fired up the App Store app and went to software update, mine kept hanging up. It actually started using up, the software update service started using up all of my processor and things were spinning. I had to go through several reboots and keep trying and trying until I finally was able to get the 10.10.4 upgrade, and then, like many of you, discovered that Apple Music didn't come with 10.10.4. We were going to have to wait for the update to iTunes. iTunes 12.2 updated from 12.1.2, and that took a while to show up. Apple actually didn't roll out the iTunes update. till much later in the afternoon. My suspicion was is that they were trying to control a little bit of the rollout and make sure that not, you know, every iOS device and every Mac was suddenly able to get into Apple Music and start streaming stuff. And specifically, I think a lot of people were very excited about getting in and trying out Beats One Radio. And I certainly was. And now that I have had a chance to try it out, I have to say, I know I like it. It's very eclectic. There is a broad mix of music that they play, and I actually kind of like that. I actually find it interesting. I also find it interesting that so many people are excited about listening to something that really sounds like traditional radio. I mean, you've got DJs, they're doing intros, they're talking over parts of tracks. They're doing all the things that DJs do on the radio, and it's nice to hear that again. It's been probably about 10 years, personally, since I've listened to the radio, mostly because, you know, just so much advertising has crept into radio, and it really got annoying to the point where it felt like almost, you know, a third to a half of the content in any given hour was simply ads. Now, Beats One Radio does have ads, but if you've been listening, what you'll notice is they do these little ad blocks, and it's just simply Beats One Radio sponsored by Amex, McDonald's. You know, they just kind of list off. I haven't heard any what I would consider traditional style ads, though I suspect those are coming. I think, you know, as the service matures, I think we're going to hear more of your traditional ad sorts of spots on Beats One Radio. I just hope that they don't get too many of them in there and that they don't become too distracting, because right now it sounds really, really great. I've actually already discovered some new music I like while listening to Beats One Radio, and I've, you know, added the stuff to my music library, or I followed individual artists where I want to check out more of their music. So it's kind of doing its job. I did find, you know, because I've been listening for basically 2 days, that it does repeat quite a bit, some of the tracks. So it does get a little bit repetitive. But again, that's another thing that's more like traditional radio, and it is being billed as a radio station. So I didn't find that all too surprising. And they did have a brief outage on the first day, although I wasn't listening at the time that that happened. It only lasted about, I think, 20 or 30 minutes. But other than that, I think they've done a great job, and it's been a very, very smooth transition for Apple to launch this new service, which I think kudos to Apple, because they've had trouble with this sort of thing in the past, and I think they have overall done pretty well. Now, while listening to Beats One Radio, I have had a couple instances where it got a little bit weird, where it just suddenly stopped playing or it started repeating stuff. All I really had to do was stop the stream and restart it, and it seemed to pick up just fine. So if you run into any of those issues, you might try that. For me, the transition over was really smooth. I really didn't have any issues, but some users have been reporting having major issues, specifically with turning on the iCloud Music Library. There have been reports of deleted songs and playlists, also mixed up metadata and artwork. So you'll go to look for a track and suddenly it says it's one thing, but when you play it, it's playing something different, or the artwork's all messed up. Some people have said they suddenly have a bunch of duplicates in their library, and that in some cases iTunes is restoring tracks that they had in iTunes Match that were deleted. Now, from what I've been reading, it seems like most of the people who are having issues are people who were already using iTunes Match, and so these problems might not be new. It might just be a case of, because Apple Music is new, people are starting to notice the problems that they were having more, because we've had reports like this ever since iTunes Match was launched. Some people have just had a hard time with iTunes Match doing weird things and duplicate tracks and all kinds of stuff showing up. So knock on wood for me personally, I've had no issues, at least none that I know of yet. I could discover them, although I poked around my library. But I just wanted to warn you on that there are some people who have had some issues. I don't know what the triggers are. I don't know what the workarounds are. I think the number one thing would be, you know, back up your iTunes library before you do the conversion or switch over to iCloud Music Library and Apple Music. And then maybe at least if something goes wrong, then you can kind of roll back to your old library and maybe start over. That's probably the best way to handle that. And then just overall for me, you know, the iTunes app, the music app, I think they're fine. I guess they're the same as they always have been. You know, iTunes is a beast, and we've talked about this on the show. I know we have. The UI's messed up. It has a lot of bloat in it. It has a lot of UI issues, a lot of UI inconsistencies. You can, you know, do multiple things from multiple different places, which in my mind is just very, very confusing. But these are all problems that iTunes had before this update. They might be compounded a little bit with some of these new features, and some of that is probably just a learning curve where we've got to figure them out. But there have been some people complaining about that. I never really had a huge problem with iTunes. I do wish Apple would take some time and attention and maybe clean things up. I'd ultimately like to see on the Mac side that it get broken into, just like on iOS, the separate applications where we have podcasts in one app, books in another app, music in another app, and videos in another app. I think that's really the way to go. And then at the same time, they could kind of overhaul the UI for each media type so that it makes a lot more sense. So I'll just say, you know, with the new music app, because the service is new and there's some changes to the app, it is going to take a while to kind of find everything and figure out how things work. Hopefully, I've pointed out a couple of them right up front so that you're not hit by things like, oh, where's my music in there? And how do I, you know, switch between artists and genres and things like that? You now know how to do that. My biggest gripe is actually with the radio section. And that's because since iTunes radio no longer works the way it did, I'm finding that particularly annoying. It's much harder to manage. If I want to, you know, add or remove an artist, I've got to go find that artist page. I've got to create a station for that. And then, you know, when I say, you know, play more like this or don't play this or never play this, I now have no way to see what I've put into that list. It's totally hidden from me. And that's a little bit frustrating. So that's going to take some getting used to. I'm hoping that maybe isn't a permanent change, that maybe they just didn't have time to kind of finish up the radio stations, the personal radio stations, and hopefully those things will get a little bit better. But so far, overall, I really like Apple Music. I'm enjoying the music that it's suggesting to me. Like I said, I found some of the recommendations that they've made really suit and meet my tastes. I've discovered some new music and artists. And that's something, you know, I've been using Spotify for a while, and that's something that really hasn't happened for me on Spotify. So as good as Spotify is in terms of the content and the music, I just have found on that service, it seems like the discovery, just the natural discovery for me and how I listen to music hasn't worked quite as well. And I think these are real personal things. I think we're going to find that some people really like how Spotify does it and other people really like how Apple Music does it. And those are probably two different groups of people. I don't think there's going to be a lot of crossover. And we've already kind of seen that online, specifically on Twitter, sort of these camps forming, the Spotify versus Apple Music people. And I think that is only going to grow and get larger in the days to come. The one real advantage, I think, of Apple Music that Apple Music is going to have over Spotify is really the integration. The thing I was talking about earlier, where when I find a piece of music through Apple Music that I like, and I say, add this to my music library, it's just in my music library, the iTunes library that I've already used for everything. And so with Spotify, there was this real disconnect. It was like, oh, did I have that stuff in Spotify or was it in iTunes? I really can't remember. Now I can just have all my music in one place, synced on all my devices. And I think that's really, really going to be the key that puts Apple Music over the top for a lot of people. So I expect the service to be really, really popular. I think Apple is going to ramp up and get a huge user base very, very quickly. I think they've done an overall pretty good job with this launch and with the service. Of course, I have to reserve judgment till I've used it for a longer period, but just the initial impression is, yeah, I really, really like it. So I'd love to know what your opinion of Apple Music is. If you'd like to share that with me, shoot me an audio comment, shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Sort of sticking with the Apple Music topic, one thing that I have to correct from last episode was a really bad reporting. I guess I can't get around it any other way. I gave you misinformation about the rate that's being paid per stream on Spotify and also on Apple Music, because I really didn't understand how the rates were written down. I was talking about Spotify's per stream rates, and I think I said that the rate was six thousandths of a cent per stream to 84 thousandths of a cent per stream. And that's totally incorrect. It's six thousandths of a dollar, which is actually really six tenths of a cent, or 84 ten thousandths of a dollar, which is really 8.4 tenths of, or 0.84 tenths of a cent for a streaming rate. So in essence, I think that works out to, for every 1,000 streams, the rights holder is going to get somewhere between $6 and $8.40. I believe I am now doing my math right. So I really wanted to correct that, because really we were doing a story on how much Apple was going to pay out to artists for the free trial period. And I think, again, I said that they were paying out 2 cents per stream. That's obviously inaccurate. The correct amount is 2 tenths of a cent per stream, or about 1/3 of the rate that they're going to get from paid subscriptions. So I'm hoping that that clears things up. And just for comparison on the free side of things, I had read that Spotify's rate for free streams, you know, so for the people who are streaming under the free Spotify accounts to the rights holders, is about 1.4 tenths of a cent per stream, where Apple is going to pay 2 tenths of a cent per stream. So just a little bit higher than that Spotify rate. But the big difference to note on the free streaming stuff is that with Spotify's free tier, that's ad supported. So they're getting some ad revenue that is being used, I think, to pay out that per streaming rate on for their free subscribers. With Apple, Apple just has the free trial and there aren't any ads. So there's no revenue coming in for free trial subscriptions. So really, Apple is going to have to pay that 2 tenths of a cent per stream completely out of pocket. Now, of course, after the free trial ends, Apple's really hoping that, you know, that free trial is going to let them convert a lot more customers to the paying service. So I think, you know, it's sort of an investment on future revenues, or revenues that are going to come later, and only time's going to tell if that actually pays out for Apple. But again, because of the quality of the service and kind of the buzz it's getting, I think it's actually going to work out really well for them. I think we're going to hear at a quarterly results call sort of that Apple is doing very, very well with Apple Music. Now, if you are going to jump in on Apple Music, you're going to get that free trial. You're going to get 90 days to try out the service, but then it is going to auto-renew and start charging you on the credit card, I think, that's tied to your Apple ID for your subscription right at the end of that trial period. So if you don't want that to happen, you could actually turn off that auto-renewal. So you can sign up today and then just go in using one of these techniques and turn off the auto-renewal, and that way you don't have to worry about it doing that. Now, if you are really enjoying the service and you want to continue using it, you may want to go back in. If you turn it off, you may want to go back in and turn it back on, but it is on by default. So on iOS, what you can do is launch the music app on your iPhone, iPad, or iPod Touch, and then tap that little account profile icon. That's the little circle in the upper left-hand corner with the silhouette of a person's head on it. And then tap on View Apple ID. And then from there, scroll all the way down to the subscription section, tap on Manage, and then you can tap on the automatic renewal switch to turn it off. And then once it's off, you tap Done. And that way, at the end of your free trial, it's not going to auto-renew. Somewhat similar on the Mac. On the Mac, you go into iTunes, you click on your name up on the kind of upper right-hand side, again, with the little circle icon with the head in it, and then go into the account info part of the dropdown. So tap on your name, click on account info, and then you'll probably have to enter your iTunes credentials, your iTunes login. And then once you're in there, you can click on the account, or once you're in the account info screen, rather, you can scroll down to the settings section and click on Manage, which is next to Subscriptions. Then from there, click on the Edit button next to your membership. And within that screen, you should see the setting for automatic renewal. You can toggle that to off and then click Done. So that's how you can manage your Apple Music subscription. And you can actually go in there, too, and switch between, say, like the family plan and the non-family plan. So just wanted to point that section out in case you were looking for it, because certainly, especially on the Mac, it's not really obvious on how to get to that. All right, I think that takes care of the Apple Music stuff and corrections. Now let's talk about passwords. This is a topic that seems to have struck a chord with our little MacCast community here. I'm getting a lot of feedback on this topic, and it's great. Please keep your emails and your audio comments coming, because I certainly want to respond to those. I'm also responding to emails, so if you just want to shoot me an email. But I thought we'd talk about a couple of the bits of feedback that I received this week, starting with this comment from John.
Hi, Adam. This is John from Palos Verdes, California, just up the coast from you. I was intrigued by your suggestion in your recent episode on passwords of using a three-word password with the website name strung along at the end of that three-word password. While I agree that that approach makes it hard for the robots to figure out the password, there is a major flaw that I think should be pointed out to your listeners. If just one of your accounts is compromised, then it's very easy for the thief to now have your password to every website because the key is so obvious. They can just take that three-word and guess on a website and add that to the end of it. That's why I use 1Password and generate a unique, random, gibberish password for every single website. That way, when one website ends up being compromised, all I have to do is change the password on that site and none of the others. With your approach, I'd have to change every password on every site, which is obviously a lot of work. Keep up the great work with your show. I've listened to every episode since show one, and I love it. Thanks.
Hey, John. Thanks. I appreciate the feedback. Yeah, I'm not really sure where I got that trick or why I chose to include it in the podcast. I'm pretty sure it probably came from some quote-unquote security website that I had read about, but after you sent me the feedback, and you weren't the only one to give me feedback on that particular tip, and it was all very similar to what you were saying, is that, you know, the using a deterministic bit of information, if that front part stays the same once sort of the code has been cracked, then you do have that issue of somebody could go back and sort of crack the code on all of the other websites. So maybe not the best advice, but I think you get the intent. And, you know, I'm a 1Password user as well, as you're going to hear throughout this episode. I actually do exactly what you're proposing, where I let 1Password generate a password for all of these websites. But I was trying to find some methodologies and some ways that people who maybe didn't want to use 1Password for one reason or another, and believe me, I think everybody should be using 1Password or something like LastPass or some of the other ones that are out there, other password management systems that are out there. I was just trying to provide an alternative, and maybe that wasn't the best alternative. And I think you're going to hear in this episode, you know, there is this sort of continuum, and that's what I wanted to talk about as we talk about passwords this time around, right? We've gone through 3 rounds of this. If you didn't hear the last episode with Bart Bichotz, definitely go back and take a listen to that. But yeah, I mean, there is this sort of idea of what kind of a password is good enough and what kind of a system is good enough. And actually, I had another listener chime in, and he sent me an email, and this was from a self-proclaimed security expert, or a guy who is a security expert, who's been doing stuff in security for over 20 years, and he said, you know, one thing I can tell you and give you advice on is that if you put anything deterministic into a password, you run the risk of being attacked. So that's anything, and we talked about this with Bart Bichotz, right? If you're using the title of a book or the title of a movie or a phrase or a quote from your favorite movie or book, or if you're using a song lyric, these are all things that hackers sort of know and can predict and put into dictionaries, and it makes their job of sort of cracking your password a little bit easier. But the guy who emailed me, the security expert who emailed me, went on to say that in that that episode of the MacCast, the one from June 7th, I think it was, he said, you provided password tips and the recommendation that you should add the name of a website to the end of a password. Regardless of how you construct your password, if you add anything deterministic to provide intelligence to the hacker, that will give them a huge head start figuring out your password. While you were right in saying the attackers have a database of known translations and password hints, these attack programs also know to look for known information. And so again, another valid point. So I think we're getting back to determining that, hey, you probably shouldn't use the technique of adding the name of the of the website to the end of the password, especially if you're going to be using the same front part. Really what you want to have is the randomness. And that's what we covered in the follow-up to that episode last week when we talked to Bart Bouchatz for a little bit. And he has the great tool, the XKPassword, XKPASSWD.net, where you can actually generate this random password. But in talking to the security expert, he even pointed out that with Bart's tool, there's some patterns that are in there. But if you actually go, Bart links to the Password Haystacks piece written up by Steve Gibson, who is another security expert, and I'll have a link to this in the show notes at maccast.com. You'll discover that, you know, necessarily having repetitive patterns or having things in there isn't necessarily a deterrent. And what we tried to get to was this concept that really length and randomness is going to be key. But, you know, we as humans, we want something that's also going to be memorable, right? It's great if you create different passwords for every website. And really, this is another important point. You should be using, every time, all the time, different passwords for every place where you have to set up a password. And this is the one area where I think a lot of us fail, and where if you're going to do that technique, you really have to use a password manager like 1Password, right? There's no way you're going to be able to remember every single password. I have 1,700 passwords in my 1Password database, and they're all different. But the point I was trying to get to is that if you use, say, a method like the one I proposed where for my 1Password, the thing that stays local and is encrypted locally and just used to encrypt my 1Password database, if you use a technique where you pick sort of 4 random words and then you intersperse those with numbers and padding and symbols and things like that in some sort of way, and this is in essence what the XKPASSWD tool from Bart does, right, is it puts together this long string, and longer the better, then that's going to be really hard for a hacker to attack or crack through brute force methods. And Steve Gibson's site actually has a tool called the Search Space Calculator, where you can plug in your password and it will kind of determine, given current techniques, how long it would take for a system to crack that password. And so I threw my password technique at this, and according to his tool, it said it would take 9.38 hundred billion trillion centuries to crack that password using a massive cracking array. That's assuming, you know, 100 trillion guesses per second. Right. So this is just a rate calculator, though. And he is very clear on his website, and I want to be very clear about this. If you go to use this tool, is it does not account for password strength, meaning that, like my password, it doesn't account for the fact that it might have known words that might be in a hacker dictionary or some of these other things, or that if there's a way for a hacker to sort of rule out certain information. So if you plug in a random password to a website and it doesn't allow, say, special characters, well, then the attacker's password program, cracking program, can throw out any combinations that have special characters. So that reduces their set of passwords that they have to randomly generate and go through. So that speeds things up. So it's not taking into account any of those things, but it kind of gives you a rough idea. You could use that that to determine, you know, what if one password is maybe better than another and what it's going to take to get brute force cracked. And that's really what this is coming down to, is if your password is compromised, if it's stolen out of someone's database, if somebody hacks into Twitter and gets the Twitter database with all the passwords and can start running programs against it, how quickly, how long is it going to take them to crack that password? And really what you want to know is that you're going to be able to go in and change the password. You're going to be able to find out that they cracked, you know, and got into that database, got into that information. You're going to want to know that and be able to get into the system and change your password before it gets cracked. So really, once that file is stolen, it's a race against time, right? And if you're using two-factor authentication, well, guess what? You have all the time in the world to get to that password, because even if they crack the password that they have, they can't get in there without that second bit of information, that two-factor part. So really, any website that you go on that offers two-factor authentication, I would really recommend turning that on and using it. I use it everywhere where I can, and it is going to help in this kind of situation. So the other thing that becomes very important is change your passwords frequently, because sometimes sites that you go to will be compromised and they won't know. They may have had their password database stolen, and the hackers, they've got their programs crunching away. They're working on your password. They're eventually, given enough time and, you know, processing power, they are eventually going to get that if they have the raw files. And there's a lot of other factors that go into this. But, you know, I guess what I'm really trying to get to is, in discussing this, I'm trying to give out techniques and ways where you can improve upon maybe the thing that you're doing now. So if you're using some insecure password, and I did this a long time ago, I used the same passwords or variations of passwords at different websites, and they were not really that great. I was doing the typical things that a lot of people do, substituting zeros for O's and threes for E's. These are all things that hackers know. They build this stuff into their programs, into their algorithms, into their dictionaries. They're going to figure this stuff out. And so you can't do that stuff anymore. You have to get better at generating your passwords. But we also need to be able to generate passwords that are human memorable, that we're going to be, you know, that aren't impossible for us to get into. And so personally, I use 1Password because I can create that one secure, strong password that's human memorable. And then I use that to get at all of my other passwords. And I let 1Password generate, in most cases, 24 character long, completely random passwords that are absolutely different for every site and service that I visit. And I change those passwords at least twice a year, in some cases, 3 or 4 times a year, just to make sure that I am protecting myself. And is it a lot of extra work? Sure, it's extra work, but I feel it's important to better protect my information and my data. And the one exception to the character length is when a site limits me on the number of characters or whether or not I can use special characters. Obviously, you have to adapt to their rules, but just know that when they force you to do that, they're giving up information to potential hackers that they can use to more easily crack your password, right? So not only are they forcing you to use a less secure password, they're giving up information that may be valuable to figuring out the key to actually cracking the passwords. But never use the same password twice. And you may or may not be willing to do the things that I'm proposing. You may or may not be willing to use 1Password. But just know, if you're not doing these things, you're taking more risk. And, you know, it's your data and it's your life. I'm not going to tell you how to live it, but I'm going to help give you some suggestions and some tools and some things that can maybe make it better. And I sort of equate it to, you know, the same conversation we have when we talk about backup, right? I often will say, you know, if you're not doing any other thing, go out and get an external USB drive, plug it in, and use Time Machine as a backup mechanism. And I'll get feedback from people who say, that's not enough, you know? And it isn't. I, you know, nothing's backed up unless you have that in two places. Well, if you only have a Time Machine backup, you really only have it in one place. But for most people, it's something that's simple enough to do. And if I can get you to take one baby step to better protecting your data, better protecting your passwords, using better passwords, that's better than nothing, right? We're moving forward. And then once you get comfortable with that, maybe you can take the next step. So that was sort of the whole point in having this conversation, is to get people thinking about this stuff and moving toward using better passwords. So great feedback from everybody. Keep it coming. You know, if I screw up and give out bad advice, I want to know about it, as you can hear, you know, see here. And then we can update it and say, okay, look, we made a mistake. Don't do that. You know, so don't do that thing that I recommended on that show where you just add the name of the website to the end of the password. I don't know where I got that, and probably wasn't a good thing to do. The last thing I want to mention is our security expert also said that he had some advice. I guess in that episode we were talking about trying to take passwords out of the Apple keychain and move them into a better system like 1Password. I didn't really know of a way to do that, but he told me about a tool called Mr. C's Tools. It's actually listed on the AgileBits discussion forums. It's not officially from AgileBits, but a member of that community wrote this little tool, and it can basically take an exported password data file from a number of different sources, including Apple's keychain, the OS X keychain, and convert that into a format that can be imported into 1Password. Now, I will warn you, it's a command line utility. I believe it's written in Perl. So you're going to want to read through all the instructions. It's not, you know, a GUI. It's not going to be the easiest thing to use. It's not super hard. But if you have the need to take passwords out of the OS X keychain and get them into 1Password, this tool might be useful to you. And again, I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. I also heard back from many of you on our discussion about using an external SSD drive as your boot drive as a way to speed up an aging Mac. And we had this conversation, you know, do I go with an internal SSD or can I get away with an external SSD? And the reason was we had a MacCast member who didn't really want to have to crack open his iMac, and he was saying, hey, can I use an external SSD? And I talked to a few people about this and came to the conclusion that really an internal SSD would be the best way to go. And I really felt the cost was going to be about the same, because by the time you looked at the cost of an internal drive, say, versus an external Thunderbolt drive, which would be your fastest external SSD, that the pricing would be about the same, even if you paid someone and didn't want to open the iMac yourself, you paid them to actually install the SSD for you. And when I made that argument, I was sort of looking at the theoretical data rates and transfer rates of the different kinds of connectors and SSDs, internal versus external, and kind of came to the conclusion that your best performance increase was going to happen with an internal drive. And I still believe that to be the case, but in talking to more people and getting some more feedback from you, I had a number of people write me and say, you know what, I went with an external SSD on my aging Mac, and the upgrade is amazing. And as a matter of fact, I'm not even using a Thunderbolt external. I'm using a USB 3 external, which is much cheaper. And you can also just get a bare drive and, you know, build your own drive with an external case. And maybe for about $150, you could get a 250 gigabyte external SSD, USB 3, boot off of it, and see a noticeable speed improvement. So I guess what I've learned is don't rule that option out. It actually looks like it is a viable option, and a lot of people are really doing that, especially if you have something, say, like a Mac Mini with the 5400 RPM drive. So, you know, there are some advantages to maybe going with an inexpensive USB 3 enclosure and then loading in an SSD drive. You could see a significant performance boost. And I did a little bit of browsing around online, and it looks like Samsung actually has a USB 3.0 500 gigabyte external drive with a case for around $215. So that looked like a pretty good deal to me, and I may even pick that up for my Mac Mini to see if I can't get a little performance boost and just, you know, clone over the drive using Carbon Copy Cloner or Super Duper, put it on the SSD and see how that goes booting from an external. And now that I think about it, I actually think I did this when my Mac had to go in the shop, my MacBook Pro, and I just transferred everything to an external SSD. Actually, I took the SSD out of my MacBook Pro, put it in an external case, and used that to boot off of from another Mac that I had lying around the house. And, you know, it was pretty snappy with the SSD. So I'm going to roll back on my advice from the last episode. I do think for resale value and for some other reasons, just ease of use, not having to carry around an external SSD, that if you can get away with doing an internal, that's probably the best way to go. But in a pinch, if you just want to do an external SSD drive, give it a shot. And I think you'll be pretty happy with the results based on the feedback that I've received over the last week or so. I don't know about you, but I have an older car, and I've often thought about upgrading the stereo system to get some more integration with my iOS devices. I think it's really cool that a lot of these new cars have voice systems and nav systems that can then interface via Bluetooth to our iOS devices, and you can get kind of this in-car integration. And I think for most people, you know, a lot of it works pretty well. I've had some rental cars here and there where I've tried to do it, and I always just kind of felt like, oh, maybe it's just me because I don't understand the system on the rental car, but it's never worked all that well for me. And that's what's sort of stopped me in the past from personally going out and spending a lot of money to upgrade my car. And now we're getting these great systems that are CarPlay enabled, but you know, they're like $700 and things like that. So I've really kind of held off on it. And I think it's because I've had an experience similar to the one that I received in this question that I got from John, who's been struggling with the podcast app and integration with his new car.
Hey, Adam, this is John from Las Vegas. I love the MacCast and love what you're doing with it. I have a quick question, and I'm hoping you can give me a point in the right direction. So two things happened at the same time. One is that I've been a longtime Instacast user, and Instacast just decided to stop developing their app. So I switched over to Apple's podcast app to listen to the MacCast and all the other great podcasts that I listen to. And I also got a new car. So the new car has all sorts of integration for my iPhone, which is great. And there's a really weird problem, which is that whenever I'm listening to a podcast in Apple's podcast app, and then the podcast ends, for whatever reason, my iPhone immediately starts playing the music app, and it starts playing alphabetically all my music in alphabetical order by song title. And the very first song in my list by alphabet is actually a heavy metal song. And so I keep getting interrupted at the end of every podcast with this heavy metal song, which I like the song, but it's just not what I'm expecting. And is there any way to get Apple's podcast app to behave properly? I've noticed this exact same behavior, by the way, in years past, because I travel for work and I would take my iPhone on the road. And any car I've ever been in, when I plug it into the USB port on the car, it does this exact same thing. So this isn't any particular model car. They all seem to do this, where if you just say play music from phone, it just starts playing in alphabetical order from the song list. It's extremely annoying. If you have any suggestions, I'd love to be able to fix this problem. What I'd love for it to do is actually just jump to the next podcast, but it doesn't seem to want to do that. As soon as the podcast ends, it immediately kicks me into the music app automatically. Quite terrible. So any help would be greatly appreciated, and thank you so much.
Hey, John, thanks for the question. Unfortunately, as I was saying earlier, I don't have a car with an integrated system, so I don't have a really easy way to test or troubleshoot this, but I did kind of poke around online. I did some Googling and searching, and I couldn't find a really good answer for you, unfortunately. So I figured what we do is play this on the MacCast, throw it out to the community, and see if anyone knows of a fix. Now, John personally actually emailed me back not long after sending this audio comment, and he himself found a workaround, which was fairly simple, and that was to create a blank audio track with the title AAA, put that into his music library, and then sync it over so that, you know, when it does flip over from the podcast and starts playing music, what he ends up with is just a silent track, and that gives him time to go back to the podcast app and queue up the next podcast. The one thing that I did think about, John, and you'll have to try this because, you know, again, I don't have a place to test this, is are you using the most recent playlist in the podcast app? This is a special kind of playlist that gets set up under My Stations. And what it does is it has all of your most recent podcasts in a single list. And then when you play from that playlist, it will play in order from one to the next without stopping. So I'm wondering if this is the kind of case where you're playing a podcast in, you know, just for that podcast, it only has one episode and it gets to the end of that and then it flips over to music. So maybe by pulling up a playlist that has multiple podcasts, regardless of which show they're associated with, all in order, that it'll simply move from one to the other. And what's cool about this playlist is if you go in there under the settings section, you can actually select which podcasts you want to be included in the most recent My Station. And then also you can decide, you know, do I only want to play unplayed episodes or every episode? And you can also decide what order to play them in, either oldest to newest or vice versa. So you can kind of set it up however you want. So you might give that a shot and see if that works as a workaround. But it's weird that it's doing it at all. I'd be curious to know why it actually is jumping from the podcast app all the way back to the music app to just start auto-playing. I have no idea why that's going on, but if someone happens to know, or again, happens to know a workaround or fix for John, please shoot us some feedback, email, audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. And finally, in the MacCast for this week, I want to do something a little bit fun. We're going to play around with Siri because I read this piece over on, I believe it was Colton Mack who broke this, but it might have been 9to5. I'm sorry, I don't remember exactly who to give the credit to. But they discovered that if you ask Siri to do this one thing that is actually impossible to do, she gets a little bit snippy with you and will actually insult you. And what it is ask her to divide 0 by 0, and this is what you'll hear.
Imagine that you have 0 cookies and you split them evenly among 0 friends. How many cookies does each person get? See, it doesn't make sense. And Cookie Monster is sad that there are no cookies. And you are sad that you have no friends.
So I have no friends and no cookies. That would make me sad, I actually think. It sounds like a little bit insulting, but I think she's just trying to really make a point. And it's a math point, right? It's that division by 0 is an operation for which you cannot find an answer. So actually on the screen, what it shows is that 0 divided by 0 is indeterminate or basically unsolvable. And the reason, and I'm going to do my best, I'm not a math guy. I happen to know a math guy, Dan Bachman, who did Dan's Math Cast. And he will email me, because I know you're listening, Dan. You're going to email me if I get this wrong, and then we'll just make a correction. But according to Siri and according to the internet, the answer to 0 divided by 0 is indeterminate. And the reason is, and why it can make sense to you, is if you understand the relationship between division and multiplication. Actually, Siri does a pretty good job of explaining it, right? If you have 0 cookies and you try to divide them up among 0 friends, you can't do that because you're starting with nothing, right? You can't take nothing and divide it into nothing. But another way to think about this, and one that made a little more sense to me, was the relationship between division and multiplication. So everybody sort of knows if you have 12 and you divide it by 6, the answer is 2, because 6 times 2 is 12. But try the same thing with 12 divided by 0, it ends up being indeterminate because 0 times nothing equals nothing, right? It's never going to be equal to 12. You can't take 0 times nothing and get it equal to 12. Anything times 0 is always 0, so it's just not going to work out for you. So that sort of made sense to me, and probably in a less insulting way than Siri tried to explain it, telling me I have no friends. Now, I don't think that was really the intent, but still funny nonetheless, and I wanted to share that with you. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, and Disc Label. Also, Text Expander Touch for iOS, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can check out all their great software, get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And our newest sponsor, Tunnel Bear. It's a really simple VPN app that will allow you to browse the internet privately and get around blocked websites. try it today by going to tunnelbear.com/maccast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at BackbeatMedia.com. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on the MacCast, you can shoot me an email. MacCast@gmail.com is the email address. You're also welcome to call into the voicemail line and leave a voicemail. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9 is the phone number. And if you'd prefer to use Skype, you can also leave a voicemail there. My Skype username is TheMacCast, so just call in and leave your messages and audio comments, and we'll get them and share them out on future episodes of the MacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online on the social medias, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. Or if you prefer Google+, you can check out the MacCast Google Plus community. Just head to google.com/plus, and that's the plus symbol, /plus MacCast. I look forward to seeing you online, but until then, I will talk to you all again real soon.